talking this afternoon with Victoria Jones of Hastings. Good afternoon, Victoria. And I look forward to hearing about your family. If you can tell us everything that you can, we'd be obliged, so that people in future generations will know all about you and your family.
Good afternoon, my name is Vicky Jones. I was born in 1940. I'm the second eldest daughter born to William Barry Wong and Atarita Wong. I come from a family of 10, 7 sisters and 3 brothers. When I was 20 years old, I gave birth to a daughter. Her father collapsed while playing rugby when she was only 3 months old. And so mum and dad decided to legally adopt my daughter. My growing up years, oh my gosh. When I was 5 years old and started going to primary school, I was always teased about my being Chinese by kids in the class. And the only way I knew how to retaliate was to fight them. So I started fighting and I kept getting sent back to the back of the room to sit by myself. The classroom I was in was all Pākehā, but in the end I just cried and just wanted to go home because I couldn't handle it.
What school?
Mahora School. Because of the work that Dad did back in those days, like he just picked up work wherever he could, and wherever he had to go to work, we had to move there to be with him. When Dad was born in China, he was born an identical twin, and we have no recollection of what his life was like from when he was born until he was 10 years old. When he was 10 years old, him and his brother were put onto a boat by an uncle that was sailing to New Zealand.
Because?
Well, because we think multiple births weren't allowed in China at the time. And so I think it was decided that the best thing for them was to come to New Zealand. So when they arrived in New Zealand 10 years old, they changed their names from their Chinese names to a name in New Zealand. And I've got his birth certificate that states he was born in 1910. When they arrived in New Zealand, Uncle was taken to Wairarapa and my dad was taken to Shannon. My uncle was raised by an uncle and Dad was raised by a French family in Shannon. We don't know what time or how old they were or how they met up in Hastings. We think that they had an uncle who was very close to them who lived here. He owned a big vegetable and fruit shop on the corner of Nelson Street and Heretonga Street back in those days. So Dad and Uncle more or less worked for their uncle in market gardens or helping in the shop and, you know, any other job they could pick up. So when I was born in 1940, Dad got a job on Wairio Station, which is still on the Matapura Road.
What station?
Waitio. It was owned by the Harper family. So while I was a baby at Wairio Station, Mum used to go and work with Dad digging the drains, and a farmer and his wife looked after me. And they must have looked after me for quite a while, because by the time Mum and Dad were ready to leave the farm, they wanted Mum and Dad to give me to them. But Mum and Dad didn't want that. So we left there, and Mum and Dad were living with our grandparents. They're my mum's Mum and Dad, our grandparents. And they lived in Oamaru in a big 5-bedroom homestead. But whenever Dad got a job away from Oamaru, we had to move to where he was working. So growing up, because there was 10 of us in our family, we were all born at different stages, you know, different ages. Like my oldest sister was 2 years older than me. I was 2 years older than the third sister, and, you know, so things that happened in my life wasn't the same as what happened with all my other sisters. You know, the relationships we had with our mum and dad were all different. But we had a good relationship with our mum and dad. You know, they taught us a lot when we were kids growing up. Taught us how to be responsible. Dad, being Chinese, taught us how important ethics were. And he used to take me to work in the gardens with him, where he taught me how to work hard. It was hard work, picking spuds up into sugar bags and dragging the bag in between your legs. Then I started school at Mahora, and we were there for 2 years before we had to move back to Oamaru with our grandparents, because Dad had picked up a job working at Matara Freezing Works down in Southland for 3 months. So we stayed with our grandparents in Oamaru, and we attended the Fernhill School at the time. It was a different school to Mahora. You know, we were welcome. No one cared what we were then. But when we were at Mahora, it was just ongoing. You know, it was really, really bad. So when we attended Fernhill School, the principal at the time had just moved there from the East Coast. Him and his wife had taught in many Māori schools on the East Coast. So when they came to teach at Fernhill School, the Fernhill Bridge divided the Fernhill community from the Oamaru community. So you had the Fernhill community on one side of the bridge and the Oamaru community, which were all Māori, because, you know, the marae is on the other side. So there were two different communities surrounding Fernhill at the time. So when we started school, the school was mixed, Māori and Pākehā, but everyone got on with each other. There was always a happy atmosphere at school. And the thing we couldn't get over was how much the principal had changed what happened at school, like got us into inter-school sports, playing all kinds of sports like basketball, rugby, hockey, tennis, softball. And they ran a gala day every year. The gala day was between, like, all the pupils at the school were split into four teams. So on the gala day, we all played team events. And every time you won a race, you had points. So at the end of the day, all your points added up. And the good thing about a gala day was that at the end of the day, the winners get to hold the school banner. It was a big thing in those days. So the leading team wins the banner and takes it for a march around the school just to show off. But while I was at school, I would have only been about 9. And the headmaster got me interested in playing tennis. I didn't know how to play tennis. So he gave me a tennis racket and sent me outside to play with the boys. And the boys used to whack the tennis ball directly at me, and I couldn't return them. But anyway, I went home and told Mum how Mr. Henderson wants me to play tennis. And she knew I had nothing, I didn't know how to play tennis, but I had a cousin who was a very good tennis player, because they had tennis courts at the marae. So he started teaching me how to play tennis when we didn't have any school. And when I come to know how to play tennis, I started playing tennis again at school and started hitting the ball back to these boys, you see, and they got a hang of a fright. So I was 9 years old, and I think the following year Mr. Henderson got me and one of the boys. He wanted to enter us into a junior tennis competition in town, boys and girls competition, and the school provided all the tennis gear that we had to wear and all that. So we both went along to the tournament, and we both got into the semi-finals. Billy Russell, the boy that went with me, he played his semi-finals, but he lost his game. I won my game, so I had to sit around and wait for the finals. I didn't know who I was playing until I ran onto the tennis court. And then someone told me I was playing against Rua Morrison. Well, at that time, she was the New Zealand junior champ. And I think the reason that they didn't tell me until I ran out on the court, because I may not have run out on the court. And I thought, oh my God. But anyway, I went out on the court and I just played my heart out. I won one game to her two, because you know, you only played three games back then. You didn't play a set like they do today. So I won the first game and she just upped her game and won the last two. But you know, when we finished playing, she came up and shook my hand and she asked me who my coach was. And I says to her, I don't have a coach. She goes to me, do you not have a coach, anyone coaching you how to play tennis? And I said, no, only my cousin when I learnt how to play tennis. And she couldn't believe it, and she just said to me that if I wanted to carry on with my tennis, there are people I could go and see, and because I knew Jack Charters at the time. He had the bicycle shop, sports shop, and he was very good to me. And so I played for the Parkvale Tennis Club, because while I was still at school and went on to high school, again, because of me being Chinese, you had to book a tennis court to get onto the court to play tennis. And for some reason or other, I could never get onto the tennis court. There was always some story why I couldn't get there. So in the end, I didn't try anymore. I just stayed with the Parkvale Tennis Club. When I finished school...
When you finished Mahora School?
No, I finished Mahora School when I was 7 years old. Then we went to Fernhill School and we stayed at Fernhill School until I was ready to go to high school. But when I went to high school, we had to join up at the boys' high because girls' high wasn't built then. So I had to run against all the boys.
Now you're talking Hastings Boys' High
yeah.
School combined?
Yeah. We had to go there for the first year until the girls' high was built. So, you know, we had a lot of sports things on at the time, and when you played any sport, you competed against the boys, which, you know, it was good because it made you play. You know, the boys were always out to beat you. And so, you know, I used to try my best. I mean, I never used to win, but at least I gave it a good go. And from tennis, because we had seven sisters in our family, we became a hockey family. Mum's family were good hockey players, and Mum's family loved music. So when we were growing up, we used to wake up to beautiful singing, guitars, drumming, every morning at the house. Our cousins had a singing group called the Clive Trio, and they were very popular back in the 1950s and 60s. So I used to travel around with them every time they went somewhere to sing. I was just so mad on music. Then I learned how to dance, so I was mad on dancing. I went everywhere to watch my auntie play the piano in the dance bands. I went everywhere with her every Saturday night. And then when the rock and roll craze came, oh my God, I just went crazy on rock and roll.
How about the Assembly Hall?
Yeah, sometimes at the Assembly Hall and then the Trades Hall.
And what's the one behind the Catholic Church?
I could only remember when they were held at the Trades Hall or the Assembly Hall. Anyway, I got really good at rock and roll. And so, you know, I didn't have trouble getting a partner.
I bet you didn't.
And one night I met this guy who was very good at rock and roll. So he taught me how to do all these good moves, you know. And I was working at the hospital then. I had started working to help Mum and Dad financially, you know, bring all my young siblings up. When we were old enough to work, we all helped Mum and Dad with money, with our younger siblings. So getting back to the rock and roll days, this guy that I met at a dance one night, and he was teaching me all the real good moves, so that was okay. Then 1960, I decided I wanted to go and work in the shearing sheds because it was more money than anywhere else where you got a job. It was better money. So we both went to the shearing sheds and
We both?
Yeah, Danny.
The rock and roll boy?
Yeah, but we were just good friends. We weren't boyfriend or girlfriend. He became my mentor. About 6 months after we started in the sheds, he went out with some of the shearers and had a real bad accident. He ended up in hospital, and when we got to know one another, he never ever spoke about his family. I used to always question him, you know, about his family, but he never wanted to talk about them. So when we went to work out in the sheds, he was always there, you know, he was always there with me, so I didn't have any trouble from any other male. But when he had the accident, he couldn't walk after the accident. So I stopped work for a while because I needed to be at the hospital with him. When he come around in ICU and he found out he couldn't walk, he had to be put into a nursing home because he still needed medical care. So while he lived at the nursing home, he more or less became my mentor. He was so good to talk to, you know. Working in the sheds was bloody hard work. And I had more bad days than good days. So I used to always run to him, crying to him, you know, because it was so hard. The work was hard and the people were mean and all that. But he was so full of wisdom, understanding, and so knowledgeable. He was only 17, you know, but he was the guy that I always went to when I needed someone to talk to. But, you know, he passed away in 2004, so I had to carry on in the shearing sheds by myself. Now, from 1960, I learnt how to rousey and work with wool. Most of the women I worked with at that time were a lot older. There were no young people in the sheds, only me. So from 1960 till about the mid-1970s, I worked with mostly older people, and they were always called old school. But they taught me the correct way of working, how to do my work properly, and they were always on my back if I was half pie. I couldn't be half pie. I had to do my work properly. In 1960, when I first started in the wool shed, there was no training for rouseys. You were always taught by someone in the sheds. No one spoke about the wool board ever in those days. The wool board was only running training courses for shearers, not for rouseys. So in 1961, I met Bill Jones, and I worked for Bill in the sheds till about 1970, and we became friends, then we became more friends, then we started a relationship. And at that time he was a shearing contractor. So the early 1970s, I joined up with Bill to help him run his shearing run, which was getting quite big at the time. Practically we shore at most of the sheds up Sherrandon. We had sheds out at Pātuka, out at Aumākere, out at Waimarama, and in late 1950s, Bill picked up the shearing at Matapuro and Ngāmatea Station. Matapuro, it's a big 12-stand shed. It's off Taihape Road. It's west of Fernhill, right. Anyway. So when Bill picked up those two big sheds, it made him the biggest contractor in North Spain. So I finished working in the sheds to help Bill to become a shearing contractor, and it was just so busy. It was hectic. I mean, you know, you not only had the shearing to worry about, you had all the workers. We were living in Hastings at the time, and the place we were living in was too small, so we had to look for a bigger place. A place came available out of Fernhill, which was owned by the Halsteads. They had a big overland trucking business. So they had a 10-acre property on the corner there next to Doug White, which we bought. So after purchasing the property, we moved the shearing out there. We then sat with one another and wondered what the hell we're going to do with this bloody 10-acre block. So we looked down the back of the property and there was just so much room. So we decided to build a shearing complex. Wasn't the best of our choices, but we were only thinking about the people we had to employ. But we had all the neighbours coming over and, oh, you know, why are we doing this? I mean, you know, we were wasting our money on shearers. And I realised that people were always putting shearing down, but never knew how hard the damn job was. But they were always putting shearing down, putting us down, and they didn't want us to build the shearing complex at all, but we did. And we used the complex the first time in 1975. And from the day we started using the shearing quarters till 87, when we sold our run to Brendan Marnie, we never had any trouble with the workers, you know. But they were hectic years. Nobody saw me because I was too busy. But, you know, all the years I worked in the shearing sheds up until 2017 when I decided to. Well, I had arthritis. But anyway, way before then, when we were out at Fernhill, you know, the shearing just got so busy. We didn't even have time to get married. So, 87, we had just had enough of shearing by then. And we sold the run to Brendan and we had to go out of shearing for 3 years. So while I was out of shearing, I went to work at the pack house, first time I ever worked in the Apple pack house. And I ended up running a pack house for 5 years and I achieved a QC certificate. And then after there, I went out pruning the grapes. I had a real time, you know, learning all these new skills. But then the love for the sheds just wouldn't go away. And in 1993, while we were out of the sheds, a lot of our farmers couldn't get on with Brendan's workers. And so they started bringing young Bill up to see if he was interested in running a shearing gang. So young Bill started up shearing about 88. And, you know, it wasn't a big run. It was just people who didn't want Brendan to do their shearing. So he carried on with it. Until 93, he got sick of the shearing, so he passed it back to his dad. And that's when I started back in the sheds. But when I went back into the sheds, everything was different.
Can I ask you, who is Brendan?
Brendan Marnie was a shearing contractor in Napier. So in 93, I went back into the sheds, and I was the head rousey. And look here, I didn't know the first thing about being a head rousey. And the way people were treating me was like, oh, you know, you shouldn't be there. You don't know how to be a head rousey. So I was 53 years old. I decided to study wool. Wasn't easy, bro. Everybody were putting me down. And I first did a wool course to gain a senior wool handling certificate, which allowed me to be a head rousey. But every time I went to be a head rousey, I wasn't good enough. So from there, I was lucky. When I took on contract shearing, I had a lot of opportunities from the shearing industry and the wool industry. And I kept getting all these wool experts, you know, teaching me different things. But when I went back into the sheds in 93, I looked up my friend Lou Willoughby. He was the our wool production officer at the time. And of course, when he came to Hawke's Bay, that's when all the wool courses started happening. So in 1977, they were wanting to run a senior wool course. They said they had advertised in papers for girls to apply to attend the course, but they never had anyone. They had no one. So they rang me and Bill. We had to look for 14 wool handlers on the Monday morning because the Ministry of Agriculture was with the Ministry of Fisheries. They were all together. You know, luckily we weren't busy. It was more or less during bane crutching. So luckily we were able to find 14 of our wool handlers, but the thing was that they had to have 3 years' experience. None of them were that experienced, but we still sent them. So we sent them along and two girls came out with certificates. And they were the first two girls in New Zealand to be qualified wool handlers. I've been trying to find out when the time started changing, because from then on, when the time started changing in the wool sheds, everything changed. I mean, for nearly 20 years, I worked with old school, you know, doing the wool the old way. And then when I went back into the sheds in 93, I didn't even know what the hell they were doing with the wool. I didn't even know what a frip was. So I had to go back to school. But oh my God, I was just so scared. You know, I had to sit 3 wallpapers. I had to sit a communication paper, and I had to sit a farm management paper. I didn't know nothing about farming. So I was waking Bill up all hours of the night, asking him questions about farming, because he was a blingin' shepherd at Mother Pearl. He's supposed to know everything about sheep farming, but he didn't know nothing. So I ended up having to go out and talk to farmers. You know, they were very helpful when they found out that I was going to Massey studying wool. I mean, you know, they thought it was great.
I can see that you learned your trade over the years.
Yeah.
You're a very strong woman as well, and you wanted to be the best.
Yeah.
And you were.
Dad taught me all that. You know, when I was young, I used to go to work with Dad every morning in the market gardens. He taught me how I need to have good work ethics like him, because he was a damn hard worker. He had the roughest pair of hands I've ever seen on a man. They were so rough, you know, was terrible. And, you know, it was the sort of job that Dad did. But he taught us more than good work ethics, you know. We all had turns bringing up our younger siblings. We all had turns keeping the house clean, you know. We were always doing those things. And then when you tried telling people what it was like growing up, they used to just laugh at you and thought it was a hell of a joke, you know, no TV, no this, no that. But, you know, when we were growing up, we never saw other families struggling. We didn't even know we were struggling. But we were quite happy with what we had. You know, Dad taught us how to grow vegetables, how to look after them. So we more or less lived off the land. Or we went eeling, we went fishing with our uncles. Then shearing came along, and that was bloody hard work. I don't know how many times I cried because I had to bend down and pick up dags with my bare hands. I thought they were having me on when they were trying to make me pick these dags up with my bare hands. So when I started studying, it was hard, you know, like it was called an extramural program where you were able to study at home and work at the same time. Well, I thought I was smart, you know, you can do all the studying and you can go to work, not a problem, but it became a problem in the end.
And how long did you do that for?
I started studying in 93. They ran the very first Q's Dental program at Massey, which I attended, and I gained a Q's Dental. And the Q's Dental made you, like, you were able to take over a wool classes job in the sheds, just grading the wool clip. And so at that time, wool classes were going out of the sheds from wool classing and leaving it to people grading the wool. So that was the first time I went to Massey, and then Lou Willoughby talks me into doing this extramural program, and I said to Lou, you do know how old I am? He goes, yes. And I said, I'm 53 years old. He said, that's not a problem, he said. And I says, I haven't been to school for ages. And because I told him when I was at school, I was just so into sports that I left school to follow my dreams playing sports. I played hockey for Hawke's Bay, tennis, what else did I do? And rugby, all for Hawke's Bay. So while I was shearing, I was playing sports as well. I mean, shearing kept me fit, so.
So women were playing rugby back in those early days?
My first time I played rugby was in 62, the night of the Blossom Festival, and I got knocked out. I got knocked out playing against Wellington. It was all right, you know. And from then on, I carried on with rugby. I played for Hawke's Bay Women. I played Hawke's Bay Hockey for Women and tennis. So I was so busy with sports and work. During the 70s was when the big change came in, the shearing sheds, you know. How we worked in the old days had to all change. That's when the quality of the job started coming in, and so we all had to make sure we did a good wool job. But it was hard trying to get girls up to that point, you know. I had to teach a lot in the sheds, because back in the day when I first started working in the sheds, Rouseys were never taught anything about the wool itself. They were only taught how to work with wool. But it was amazing watching the way they worked with wool and not even know anything about the wool. Because back in those days, they did their work properly and your work had to be precise.
Did you choose the wool at that stage to be put into shows for competition?
Yeah, you had to be trained to do that, because, you know, you had to tell the difference between wool with character and, you know, everything. There's so much that goes into choosing a wool for the show, and if you don't know that, you just shouldn't bother.
But you knew.
Yeah, but, you know, it's when you learn to be a wool classer, you learn all that.
And were you successful in a lot of those shows with the wool that you showed on behalf of the owner, I suppose?
I used to choose wool out of Jack Roberts, out of his wool, because he's got Corridales, beautiful wool. But, you know, the downfall on Corridales is that they have that hard crust running through the backs of the fleeces that you have to be very aware of. Sometimes you can't see it. But we do a lot of work for Jack Roberts. Mind you, they own Ngamatea. And I'll tell you what, I can tell you a few stories about Ngamatea.
Yeah, that's a big property, isn't it?
The first time I went up to Ngamatea Station, the road was just like two wheel tracks, bush everywhere. And we had to travel on the back of Bedford trucks up to Ngamatea, and that took over 3 hours. Getting up to the Ngamatea Gateway took 2.5. You still had 7 hours more to travel into the sheds itself. His father was, well, when you saw him dressed up, he dressed like a beggar. He had holes in his clothes and I couldn't believe he was a farmer with a big farm and he was dressed like a beggar.
What was his name?
Lawrence Roberts. But he was such a hard worker. And I think at the time when they were, see, they didn't take over Ngamatea until the 1930s. And when they took over Ngamatea, they needed a lot of money to get it up to scratch, and they still weren't able to do that. People we took up to Ngamatea to work, they just fell in love with the place. And every year we always had people ringing up, trying to get up to Ngamatea, but, you know, we were always full up with workers to go up there. People just wanted to go up there for a ride to see what the place, why people are falling in love with this place.
And a great name.
Yeah, you see, when we did the shearing up there for 30 years, they never did anything to the quarters. But, you know, the people back in the day, I'm talking about time when people had to work for a living, they didn't care what the place they lived in. They didn't care about that. What was important to them was that they had a job, and that's what Ngamatea was like. I mean, Ngamatea quarters weren't flash, but then they weren't that bad. And you know, there's always a bad egg in the basket. There was always someone moaning. But you know, we always say, well, you know, we're way out in the wops. If you don't like it, there's the road. And it's a long way to walk home. But, you know, everybody used to fall in love with Ngamatea. I think it was because, you know, you could go out pig hunting, but everybody enjoyed themselves up there. And people in the sheds today that used to work for me and Bill back in the day, You know, they always say to me, oh, the good times are gone out of the sheds. Because, you know, today it's all about how much money you can make. People never worried about how much money you made back in the day, as long as you had a job.
Victoria, when did the Apertys come into the picture?
Oh, they're related to me. They're related to me on my mum's side.
Yeah.
We saw foray, because Terry married Lawrence Roberts' daughter, Margaret. Saw foray, we saw for Ken, so we knew the Apertys very well.
Ray died too early, didn't he?
No, he was a lovely man.
He was.
You know, he was a real gentleman.
Yeah.
Even Ken. I used to always go and see Ken, you know. He was always very good to me. They were all good to me.
I think one of the boys is up on the farm.
You know,
well,
you talk about upper twos. About 2 weeks before Ren had his accident, he rang me up. He was just starting to realise how bad wool is actually being done in the sheds. And he wanted to talk to me what was my opinion about, you know, bad wool jobs. And I says to him, you know, it's terrible. People just don't want to do the work because they don't think they're being paid enough money to do the work. And, you know, I says to Ren that the work they expect, the work farmers expect girls to do with their wool. I said to them, sometimes you see wool coming in a shed full of pen stain. There's not a hell of a lot you can do with the wool. And I said to him, you can't even take the bad part of pen stain out because the rest of the clip is still pen stain, so there was no use. And it's the same when the wool is all yellow. And so, you know, Ren was going to change all that. And his accident was just one big shock. But anyway, before he died, I had a photo of his dad with Bill when they pressed the 1,000th bale up there. And so I got a copy done and posted it to him, and he was ever so thankful. He said he had one, but someone pinched him. But he was a lovely boy, and I think young Nate is up there now.
Yeah. Now, when did you actually retire from your work?
2 years ago.
So, no word.
I was 77 when I finished in 2017, only because the last 2 years I worked in the sheds with arthritis. I was managing my pain all right, but it was mainly people's attitudes. I could manage my pain, but I couldn't manage all the dramas. But then again, you know, I was waiting for an operation. I've had a full hip replacement, and ever since I had the op, it's been marvellous. I've never had any pain or anything. And yeah, I was sitting up coming out of the theatre. I couldn't feel any pain.
Well, at least because some people have a lot of trouble afterwards.
I know. I was out of hospital within the 2 days. And of course, you know, they don't send you to physio anymore. You do it all yourself at home.
Right. You've had no trouble?
No.
Very lucky. I've seen some people, they pop it out.
You know when it pops out, is that another operation you have to have? Yeah. The surgeon did tell me that if I went back into the sheds, I would have to watch that I don't fall because I could dislocate my hip, and I just didn't want to do that. So I retired. I've always wanted to write a book.
And what's the name of the book?
Sharing a Way of Life. Well, it was my way of life.
And when do you think that'll hit the shelves?
We've submitted the first edit, and the publishers think the story is good enough to go into a competition. I had to pay $500 to put it into this competition, and they think that my story's got a show of winning the competition. So if it hopefully wins the competition, I won't have to pay to have it published. But they think that probably a couple of months or a bit more than that. We were going to have a book launch in Hastings, but it would have to be when Shearing's not busy, because I think that's when most people would come and buy the book. They've made arrangements with Whitcall New Zealand to sell the book.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
You've put a lot of work into it.
I know, I can't believe how much work I've put in.
Well done, it will be a very interesting book. I'll look forward to having a look at that. Reading it.
I will bring you a copy.
Will you?
Yes.
Yeah, well, I hope you'll keep in touch with us, and when you have that launch, then you know, we might be able to follow up on it as well.
Yeah.
That's a great story you've told us today, and of course the Wong family is well known in Hawke's Bay.
Yeah.
In vegetable shops.
Can you remember, it used to be right on the corner, you know where John Bakery is?
Yes, I do.
That's where the shop was, on that corner.
Opposite Mick Thompson.
Yeah, and my dad and his twin brother, they used to work there when they didn't have to work out in the market gardens.
My mother used to go to Our Wing.
Yeah, I remember Our Wing.
You
know,
on the other end of town.
Lou Key. Where was Lou Key? Do you remember the old billiard saloon?
Yes, Donovan's.
My dad used to work in there at night on the weekends. And I used to stay in this little hut behind this little Chinese vegetable shop, trying to think whereabouts it was. And I think it's somewhere around by where, just about opposite Hallensteins, I think, somewhere in that block. And that's where I used to sleep and wait for Dad to come home.
Well, that was near the Pacific Hotel.
Yeah, yeah.
No wonder you stayed there.
Oh, you know, I know, I remember all the pubs when we were sort of shearers. We used to go to the Stortford Lodge, the pub used to be full of shearers.
That's right, that's right. Okay, well, I think we might have just about come to the end, and I thank you very much indeed for putting
the
time and telling us your story.
I'm glad I came here.
Yeah, I'm sure the Knowledge Bank will be absolutely so pleased.
Oh, will they? Well,
yes,
you know, if you want to know anything, just give me a ring and I can pop back over here.
I will. I'll be putting your name in the front row.
Anything you need help with?
Thank you. Thank you, Victoria. Lovely talk, and very pleased that I had the opportunity to interview you today.